Greetings, my friends. It is so exciting to be back on Blog Talk Radio after a 4-year absence. And I can't even believe it's been that long since I had to put aside the Blog Critics account when we moved over to Technorati. And they just weren't amenable to the whole Blog Talk Radio experience, which I have always found to be amazing. I'm Eric Olson, and welcome to America's Most Haunted. We are so excited to announce a combination of forthcoming book, website, Twitter account, Facebook account, and most germane, our new Blog Talk Radio show. And my co-host, co-author, co-everything, partner on the America's Most Haunted Endeavor is the world-famous haunted housewife, Teresa Argy. How you doing, Teresa?
I'm doing great, Eric. This is an exciting venture for us. I'm glad to be on with you, partner in everything, almost everything, that is. I'm really excited about tonight. I think Don would have something to say about that. Tonight, we're starting this off with a bang. We have a very special guest joining us this evening. I'm very excited about it. This is a gentleman that I've spoke with before, and he was our absolute first choice to launch our new show. And I think you'll find him fascinating, Eric.
And his name is?
Bill Murphy. That is Bill Murphy from Sci-Fi's hit show, Fact or Fake. He will be joining us shortly. Can't wait to speak with him again. And if you don't know who Bill Murphy is, where have you been? You must not be watching any television, but there's so much more to him than just what you see on the Sci-Fi show. Bill is a very experienced in field investigation. He's considered a leader in the field of paranormal phenomena. He has a substantial following in the paranormal community through terrestrial radio, webcast, television productions, and independently released DVDs and live presentations. We're going to talk to Bill tonight about some of those DVDs. They are fascinating. He's doing some work in the paranormal field that no one else is doing, and he's doing it a little bit differently. With over 20 years of experience investigating everything from UFOs to ghosts and cryptids, he provides the team at Sci-Fi Channel's hit show with an encyclopedia of knowledge of the unexplained. While looking for answers to some of the mysteries the team encounters, Bill works to bring in new technology to enhance their efforts. Some of his technology is a little bit different, and some of his approaches are going to be mind-blowing. So if you haven't heard about what Bill is up to, we're going to get into that tonight. And you can find out more about his documentaries and information on his fascinating work with thought form manifestation at his website at ghosttown.tv. So I can't wait for him to come on with us. We got a lot of questions for him, and he's gonna fascinate everybody. Wait to hear some of the things that he's got going on.
Well, he's got the piezoelectric effect, I know that.
Oh, and we're going to talk to him tonight about an event he did at the Glen Tavern Inn, and this was an experimental piece, and I can't wait to get in and talk to him about this. He is more than just a ghost hunter. He is more than just an investigator. He goes far beyond what many of us do in the field. He really brings technology and science into it. And he uses real science. He's working with some of the greatest people in the field, and it's a little bit different. It's not being done, at least to my knowledge, not in the public anyway. I mean, people are doing a lot of work. They're coming up with new technologies. But stuff that Bill does is definitely different, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Amazing. Well, we will wait to hear from Bill. We're very excited to chat with him. Speaking of which, you can join us in the chat room, I believe. We got Dawn back at home. I'm over at the office, and Dawn, in theory, is running our chat, so we're trying to get that going, get this all figured out. Boy, they've spruced up the technology in the last 4 years on good old Blog Talk Radio. New studio here. I'm running from my computer. Very exciting. Hey, in case people don't know who you are, Teresa, why don't we give a little bit about your background? You are the haunted housewife.
I am the haunted housewife. I work with other haunted housewives. We've done a little bit of this and a little bit of that. My partner, Kathy Weber, my fellow haunted housewife, and I have been featured along with our teammate Darla Spector, I'm getting them all mixed up. We were on Paranormal Challenge last year. We did a little thing on America Now with Lisa Gibbons. Kathy and I have an upcoming appearance on Biography Channel for My Ghost Story, which is the new hit thing to do, apparently, in the paranormal field. Everybody we know is doing that. It's kind of fun.
Not me. I'm sad.
Yeah, well, you know. You got to be with the in crowd, Eric.
I'm trying.
We've got some other things in the works. But in the meantime, this other project I'm working on is keeping me pretty busy. I'm writing a book.
You're writing a book? America's Most Haunted. It's amazing. Hey, guess what? Bill has joined us. Bill, are you there?
I am here.
Bill, what a pleasure to meet you. I'm Eric Olson, and of course with me is Teresa Argy, and you are our first guest on the inaugural episode of our America's Most Haunted show on Blog Talk Radio. We are honored to have you.
Well, Eric and Teresa, it's an honor to be here on your maiden broadcast.
Yes. I like that there's all these different words for the first time. It's our virgin voyage.
There you go.
I haven't used that word in a while. Well, welcome,
I haven't even thought about it.
It's really great to have you on. It's going to be great talking to you again. Kathy and I spoke with you a while back on another radio show. We had a great time, and I'm so glad that you joined us tonight, and I can't wait to hear what's been going on with you.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, so fire away. I'm yours for the next hour.
Excellent, and this time we won't keep you too long. He was so gracious last time. I kept him an extra hour, but he was very gracious about it. Tonight, we're going to keep to the schedule. We did our little intro on you, and I know a little bit about you. Eric knows a little bit about you, and I'm sure our listeners know a little bit about you. But we want to know a little bit more about Bill Murphy. So, Bill, we all know you from Fact or Fate, Sci-Fi's hit show, but tell us a little bit about your life before Fact or Fate and how you got to that point where you joined that team. Tell us a little bit about what happened and what got you involved in the paranormal that brought you to that point where you joined the Fact or Fate show.
Well, I had been beginning to document claims of the paranormal for so many years ago. I started, it was 1992 was really when it began. I think we may have touched upon this during that very fun interview I had with you and Kathy a while back. And it almost just grew up into, you know, studying the subject because my parents were very much into it. And so I was surrounded by books about the paranormal. You know, I was a kid looking through the arm rails of the stairs going upstairs, peering down into the living room where my parents had these conversations with their guests, speculating about all sorts of subjects, you know, cryptids, hauntings, etc. And it was almost like, oh, that's grown-up talk. I'm going to go upstairs and, you know, I have a Super Bowl. I'm going to go upstairs for my Super Bowl. I'm bored with this. And so I was kind of like, you know, if you're around something all the time, like great Italian cooking, it's hard to be impressed when you go to a well-known Italian restaurant because, you have it all the time. So growing up with it, you know, I'll have to admit, at the time as a kid, I became slightly jaded towards a lot of these stories, but they had a fantastic library, and I found myself not wanting to necessarily be a part of their conversations, but I was still reading about it all the time. And I moved to Hollywood from New Orleans, and once I got to Hollywood, I would go back to visit my parents, and it was on a return visit to New Orleans that I kind of like, you know what? I want to see if I can, instead of just reading about or hearing about a story, I want to see if I can document this. I want to see if I can record any of this evidence that people are reporting. And so that's where it started. And then, you know, ultimately I released a series of documentaries, and then I did some work for, I heard you say at the beginning that you're going to be on My Ghost Story.
Yeah.
I actually did some story production for the Biography Channel for that show. And then I ended up on the Discovery Channel on Ghost Lab, and then Dr. Fate, I was contacted by the Sci-Fi Channel, and that's been where I've had the widest exposure has been on Dr. Fate.
Yeah, it's a great show. I love it. I've loved it from day one. I kind of got into it, or I approached it knowing best before the show aired, Jael, because I've been a big fan of hers from Destination Truth. But you guys really work together well as a team, and it's fun to see kind of the interaction and how you kind of mix and match when you go off on your various endeavors. But I'm always amazed by how clever you guys are in coming up with these methods for testing. Is that something that everyone participates in, or is that something that I know you're listed as lead scientist, that might imply that you're even more involved than some of the others in plotting out these schemes for testing these things?
Well, you know, I would never be one to take away credit from the group participation that is required to make it work. I do propose a lot of experiments. A substantial amount of the gear is my own gear that I bring that we use in the show, as opposed to some of the stuff they bought since, you know, after second season on, when it's like, okay, what's your wish list? And so I would put together a list of items that I would want to see used that I don't currently have. Because when you bring your own stuff, well, you guys know how it is. You go on an investigation, you have a camera set on the tripod, it's dark, invariably, you know, somebody would trip on the tripod and the camera goes toppling over. So it was something that's wear and tear that was happening on my gear. And so it was like the network and the production company, they were really cool. You know what? Let's just replace some of the gear that's getting wrecked. Let's buy some new stuff. Tell us what you would need to make it work better. And so that's been a real plus, that having access to gear that I didn't already own. But I, you know, I have a huge personal investment in a lot of gear already. But we do all work together well. And I'm not trying to not answer your question about where do we come up with the ideas for the experiments. It is a group process. Ben and I are heavily involved with all of that. But without the talents everybody brings to the table, it wouldn't work. But I would need to add that being TV, you're seeing the successful executions of our experiments. The results may not always match the way we want them to, but you know, you're seeing things kind of work right. You're not seeing all the failures, all the crashes, all the let's rig this up, this ought to work, crash, boom, uh-oh, we got to re-rig this. You know, all that gets kind of cut out because we're not really experts at building everything. We're just sort of hodgepodging and doing the best we can. And, yeah, there's things that kind of fall apart. And from the very beginning, things will fall apart. Like, did you guys catch the Nightcrawler episode, season one? Where,
oh, yeah.
You know, okay, well, that was epic fails several times on trying to get that rig set up. And you know, you really don't see that except for one time. There was a special that was aired. Of all people, Subway Sandwiches, they sponsored it, like the bloopers from Fact or Fake. And it was everything that went wrong. And they aired this one thing that they cut together, and they never aired it again. I didn't record it. I missed it. I heard about it afterwards, and I was like, oh, man, I would like to have seen some of that.
Well,
that was a very memorable episode too. Not for the reason you remember it, but that was something that was new to me, and I've been researching the paranormal for quite a while. But the Nightcrawler episode was really new to me, and I hadn't really heard much about it at all until you covered that. That kind of stuff that the show does fascinates me, because you've gone beyond just ghosts, and you've gone beyond even cryptids, and you get people involved because people are sending in their videos and you're getting them off YouTube or whatever. And the whole concept of the show just works brilliantly, and your timing was perfect, bringing something new to reality television while still staying in the genre of the paranormal. Now, you mentioned that you came from New Orleans, and I know that your documentary about what happened in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina was based on your experience when you went back there. And I know I'm kind of getting off the Fact or Fake subject, but I really want to know, and I have our listeners know, a little bit more about your documentaries and your work about what you saw in Katrina, I mean, in New Orleans after Katrina.
Sure, sure. More than to talk about that. That was actually my first documentary that I released. Prior to that, and I'll jump right back to that particular DVD in a moment, but prior to that, I had been, as I mentioned previously, trying to obtain documentation to validate claims of paranormal phenomena, whatever they may be, you know. So I was, you know, setting up audio recorders, bunch of cameras, and I was really turning over all the media to the groups that I was tagging along with. It was a way of me seeing how different teams in different parts of the country, how they engage in their research and investigation. So it was just part of like an extension of my own education. But I didn't really hold on to that media. Now, with being from New Orleans when Katrina hit, I did decide to go there shortly afterwards, but I did not necessarily go with the intention of looking at it from a paranormal investigator's perspective. That happened organically. Even though I was already very much into the paranormal, I went there because it was my hometown and it had been wrecked. And I'd been going there 4 to 5 times every single year as my parents were aging, just to, you know, keep the family intact. I have a bunch of brothers, and all of us were always flying into New Orleans. Either we try to go when we can together, but invariably with everybody's busy lifestyles, we would go at different times. I had a technology-based business that was doing well, so I had the most opportunity to travel when I chose to at that time. And so I was going there, like I said, about 5 times a year. And so Katrina happens. I hired a crew. I said, let's head down to New Orleans. Let's document this from the perspective of the residents, not from like, look at the scale of the disaster, but the impact on people, the human cost in terms of emotion. I just wanted to capture this because it's my hometown, and I know the people. And so I was very much welcomed there everywhere I went. As a matter of fact, we were overwhelmed with requests to be interviewed. And I was kind of concerned about that going in, like, am I going to be perceived as an opportunist to go in to document this? But I didn't really know where I was going to go with the footage. I just wanted to go cover it. I was shocked at how widespread it was, but the stories that people were telling were very consistently stories of loss of loved ones that were still remaining in communication with those that survived. So it became this paranormal perspective on its own. Not that I tried to cut it that way. And so It's titled The World's Largest Ghost Town. I covered not just New Orleans, but I went throughout Louisiana. So it's got 6 very distinct places that gives you a feel of the whole state, from the swamps to the plantations to the Lower Ninth Ward, to the French Quarter, to private residences. It's got it all in there. It was my first piece that I kind of cut together and released. So it's, looking back at it, I wouldn't cut it together the way I do now, because now I shoot things that more episodic, like you can watch the whole thing in 90 minutes and it's one continuous experience for the viewer. This is very chapter-oriented, kind of like DVDs used to be cut together. So it had to be the way because there was no connection between any of the locations that I covered. It's quite macabre. It's quite touching. The emotion simmers right there. It just comes off the screen. Some of the parts are hard for me to watch, to be honest with you, because the stories were really sad. And some of the people that when we were putting it together and I was getting some colleagues to review it, they were like, are you sure you actually want to be showing this? This is a very, you know, private story that these people are sharing. But the survivors wanted their stories told. So I had to use, you know, good taste in what I would actually show or not show, because it was a catastrophe of proportions that I couldn't have imagined that one city could endure. 80% of the city wrecked. Most of it now remains wrecked. A lot of residents moved out and never returned. So it's a strong piece. It still sells really well. I gave many copies to people throughout Louisiana that participated, who then sold them themselves so they could, their story could help them. By telling their story on DVD, they could sell it. The money was theirs. I did all the duplications for them in packaging and sent them out to them. And they sold them and kept the proceeds, which is what I kind of wanted to do. I wanted to help in any way I could, mm-hmm. and so I used my own resources and experience and knowledge to help people in that way.
Bill, let's remind people where they can get that. Where they can get that film as well as your other films, of course.
You can get it on ghosttown.tv. It's all one word, ghosttown.tv. I think somebody posted it on the...
Yeah, I see it there. For those who are not chatting with us.
Now, that had to be cathartic, though, for the people who are telling their stories. I mean, there has to be some healing with the telling of the story. As hard as it is, you could relate to them because you were a resident there. And, I mean, if they didn't want their stories told, they wouldn't have shared it with you. And I think that their healing comes with time, but also healing comes with sharing and sharing what happened to them. And I think that it's beautiful, it's poignant, and it's sad at the same time. My husband also was a resident of New Orleans for many years, and we did lose people in Katrina. So it, you know, it touched us a little bit as well. I mean, we did feel a personal effect from it, not as much obviously as had we been living there. But you know, sometimes you just want a shoulder to cry on, you want somebody to hear your story and tell about your lost loved ones, because their memory then lives on. Now, relating that to a little bit of paranormal topic, what is your theory about why the place is so haunted? Because obviously New Orleans was reputed to be haunted before Katrina, and now with this disaster, apparently the activity is really increased dramatically. Do you think that it is, what do you think it is? What is your theory on that?
Well, an environment can certainly hold an emotion. It's like a residual after effect. I use the term a trauma signature when it's widespread like that. There was so much loss so suddenly, in such a horrific manner by so many people, that it could be overwhelming. But the spirit of New Orleans is one of celebrating life, and ultimately that did overcome it. But those the losses kind of remain. I mean, they're still there. The people, you know, you may not have the angst that you once did when a person is suddenly swept away, but you will always miss them. And
right.
the memory sort of keeps them alive, so to speak. And I think that it reinforces an atmosphere that's very conducive to a haunting remaining. Some people may remain at locations because they love it. Some of them may, when I say people, I'm talking in a spiritual sense,
sure.
And others may remain at a location because they've been unable to accept what has happened because it's been so sudden. And New Orleans has had tragedy throughout its existence. It's a place that almost never should have been settled in. I mean, it's below sea level. It was, the swamps were filled in. So the only way to protect the city is with a series of levees. I mean, you know, you know what it's like. You've been there, I'm certain. And when you stand up on the levee and, you know, you go, wow, here's the river and there's the French Quarter, that's like, you know, almost to the second floor.
You're looking up at the river. You're looking up at the boats. That's what I saw when I went down there. I was fascinated. I'm like, I'm looking up at it, you know, sitting at a cafe and watching the boats go by. It was bizarre. I'm from Cleveland, so it is a unique city for sure. I mean, you have to be there to experience it.
And then you have the lake as well, Lake Pontchartrain. So it flooded from the lake as well. So it was complete without any prejudice who was going to be affected. It was all neighborhoods, the wealthy, the impoverished, everybody took a hit. And then, you know, even those that survived, I mean, there was the phrase that was used afterwards that Katrina keeps killing. And I know that's a very macabre phrase to use. I didn't come up with it. I was told this by some of the people months later. And the reason why they say that is because a lot of the people that had to leave and were displaced, some of those people actually weren't really able to be moved that easily. You had the elderly. You had those that had to be evacuated. You had oppressive heat. And you have to move these people, some of them with oxygen tanks, some of them partially paralyzed, and they get moved and they uproot, they lose all of their possessions. Now they're in another state, and then they die shortly after they arrived, and in many cases in Florida, and they perish. So those that did not die initially, some of them didn't survive the few months afterwards. I was on pins and needles when Hurricane Katrina came, and I was like, oh, wow, it's gone too far west into the Gulf. I said, it's, you know, even if it's meant to turn direction now, there's going to be hurricane force winds and waves that are going to be devastating. If only came to, I was like, okay, now it's starting to turn. So as we all know, the hurricane turned, it made its way out. It did go into landfall. It swept up a lot of that marsh and swamp, and it threw the marsh itself miles and miles inward. We drove through neighborhoods where the marsh had landed on top of houses. So instead of seeing houses, you're seeing that rooty mass that is the swamp itself laying on top of houses for endless numbers of blocks. And it's a very odd thing to see because you normally don't see marsh like that. You see it, it's almost like a trampoline. You can take up a boat, and you can ride on top of it, and you jump out on it, and you kind of jump up and down on top of that marsh, and the water squirts out. Well, you pick it up, and it's like this organic film of a root mass, and you pick it up as like a big giant skin, and you plop it onto neighborhoods. It blocks roadways, it covers houses, it covers doors, windows, everything. Escape is nearly impossible for many people. I'd never seen anything like it. I also had never seen what the force of water would do to twist trees. You're talking 150-year-old trees twisted like they were made out of clay. Just like stone. And houses, you know, so many houses were displaced off the foundations. You mentioned boats, you know, the iconic shots of the barge that went over the levee when the initial surge happened, when you had the breach, and that barge, which was, you know, I'd probably say it was about a 70 or 80 foot long barge, floated into the lower Ninth Ward and settled into a neighborhood right on top of houses and streets. And
it's like a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a horror movie. I was just shocked. And, you know, we had permits, and I contacted the Los Angeles Police Department, let them know what I was doing. I had to meet with them, and they said, where are you from, Bill? I said, I'm actually from here. Well, your license says Los Angeles. I said, yeah, I moved to Los Angeles, but I'm from here. I've got lots of family here. And they go, okay. They go, you know what? We consider you a local. They said, and so they opened the roadblocks. They said, go on in. They said, if you want to go in the houses and you want to document this, that's fine, but just don't move anybody's property. And they go, not that you'll want to touch anything, and you'll see what we mean after you see it. So we did that. We police escorted us in, and we went into some of these houses that had been abandoned, and everything was covered with this mold, like so fast, because the water sat for over 2 weeks, about 6 feet up into many of the houses. So, you know, the entire first floors in some places going into the second floors or lapping into the attic was submerged underwater until it finally resided a few feet. And then it took months for it to you really all go away. But for weeks, it just sat. And so everything that was in there, wood would be melted, like ceiling fans from being soaked and then hot were like dripping down. Like it's actually in the documentary. I cover some of this stuff. You see it. And you see this gray mold and everything. And we were shooting. We're horrified. We retreat after days. It's like, okay, let's get a place in the French Quarter. Let's get a hotel room. Let's cool off for a while. And we're in this little cafe watching CNN. And news alert, health warning. All those in New Orleans, do not go into. And they start naming all the sections that we had been in. And it said, toxic mold. Don't go in there without hazmat suits. You will breathe in these spores. And they start talking about everything that these spores would cause if you inhale them. And the irony is that I had all that hazmat equipment. But once we drove into the ninth ward, we hadn't seen it, or the lower ninth ward specifically, we hadn't seen anything like it before. And everybody, like, tumbled out of the van. The camera people, the people I had with me, the crew, they all jumped out and go, wow, what are we looking at here? And so we ended up looking at everything, and the police were like, okay, you're on your own. And they split, and we went and we shot for days anyway, leading boxes of masks and suits that I had bought just for that purpose, still sealed in the back of our vans. But I think I'm okay. I didn't really seem to attack because it was shocking. My heart goes out still to those people. I still have a lot of friends there. I have family there. We lost two houses, but thankfully no lives in my family were lost. They did evacuate. And that's the world's largest ghost town. There's some stories in there that when you hear firsthand and you see the evidence, you're going to go, wow, this is serious. This is how a haunting actually begins. Even though it was already a haunted location, some of these stories you can tell this is the origin of a ghost right now that we're witnessing. At least you're witnessing it in a recorded version. But when they're seeing it and listening to it, we realize it's going to start now. It's already happening. So it was quite an experience.
Amazing thing, or fascinating thing about New Orleans too, because of the water level, as you mentioned, is the burials are all above ground, right?
Well, the majority of them are, and many caskets did pop up. As a matter of fact, my mom died shortly before Katrina, and so she died of natural causes. And so we went there, and my parents had like a beautiful plot and a wonderful cemetery there, one of the nicest ones. And they bought it years ago, and it was just like, this is a beautiful area. It's on a little natural mound. It's very peaceful. It's you know, we knew what my mother and father, what their burial plans were. And so after my mom died, and, you know, we accompanied my father to the funeral home, and they do this, and their intentions, they mean well, so I'm not at all, what I'm about to tell you is not derogatory in any sense, but there's this upsell process. They go, well, you know, you may well consider a mausoleum. It'll be above ground. It'll cost, you know, X amount more, another five-figure amount. But now you'll be up in a marble mausoleum, and it won't be those plots. It'll be in another section. Here it is. And we were kind of like, we were already in shock because of my mom's passing.
Right.
This is kind of weird. This is turning into like a sales visit. You know, we're trying to do burial plans, and my father goes, "No, I want to do it. I want to move. I don't want it to be in the plot. I want the mausoleum." And where it's, you know, it's my father's decision to make, and he made it. And they, you know, the funeral director was saying, you know, if there's a catastrophic flood in New Orleans, you could very well expect many caskets to pop up. My father said, "I don't want that. I don't want your mom to get soaked." And so he used up. So they did get a mausoleum. It's very high up. He passed away. They were both in a mausoleum. right before Katrina. As far as my dad's passing, my mom was several years before that. My dad was 3 months before. And so now they're like 7 feet up in a marble mausoleum, and it's beautiful to go visit, and the water level reached about a foot and a half below that.
So, oh, my.
Thankfully, the burial wishes were granted, and they got what they wanted.
Well, in that case, it certainly worked out for the best, it sounds like. As mixed feelings on things like this, and of course, we're very sorry to hear about your parents. That's, you know, very sad at any age and at any time. You know, I'm just checking out the chat room. We're getting a couple questions, and we don't want to jump around too much. I'm fascinated with hearing your narrative, and it has a logic of its own, which I think is fascinating. But people are asking, in fact, Robin asked, what is next for you, Bill? Because you're, as I understand it, you're now on hiatus from Factor Fake. Is that true?
Yeah, and at it's normal at the end of every season. So we always have a hiatus. Everybody sort of disperses. We all stay in touch. I mean, you know, we have a good camaraderie going on with the team, and so
it really seems like it. It seems real. It feels real.
It is. I mean, we enjoy what we do. The challenges are ones that we want to be able to solve if we can. We do realize that replication does not mean the only explanation. So we have to strike that delicate balance of don't make it too complicated of a replication attempt. Look for something that's going to be reasonable. But we stay in touch. And so the hiatus happens, you know, this is the third time it's happened. We've had three seasons. And at the end, everything just kind of goes silent. But everybody kind of needs the opportunity to get caught up with everything that your life kind of gets put on hold when you're shooting, because you're always on the road. You're living out of suitcases. It's all about going from case to case and traveling. So international travel certainly has its perks. It's wonderful to see the world. But meanwhile, you have an ever-growing pile of laundry when you go home that you toss and you grab new clothes. Eventually, it's catch-up time. So we're catching up on a lot of things we need to do. And I'm doing conference speaks all the time. I'm always on the circuit, so... being home doesn't mean necessarily time off.
Now, are you planning another event? There was an event you did in the spring at the Glen Tavern Inn, and I'm dying to hear about that. And I'm hoping that you'll be announcing soon that you're planning another one. And let's tell our listeners a little bit about the Pearl Experiment that you did at the Glen Tavern Inn, and maybe you can we can talk you into having another one soon.
Sure. I'll give you the truncated version. In 2007, I was invited to speak at a Paranormal Thing conference at the Glen Tavern Inn. I was inspired by these researchers from the 1970s, these parapsychologists, that wanted to see if you could, in a bit of a ceremony that would resemble like a seance, actually, of trying to conjure a spirit, could you actually create what would appear to be a thought form.
I hear a spirit of a dog just created.
Yeah, the dog's going to be a spirit if he keeps barking all the time. Yeah, this thought form manifestation idea is fascinating to me.
Well, you know what? I was fascinated by the original experiment, the Philip experiment, and the data. And then research into history, it goes much further. It was like actually thousands of years, the creation of thought forms for various purposes. And so I wanted to see, well, you know, is this something, again, my tendency to always want to document. I didn't want to just have this a case of people's perceptions that a thought form would exist, but can you actually record the presence of a thought form that would manifest in some way? And it seemed like a harebrained enough idea that I wanted to go with it. And so we did. And so we had this. We kept it in secret. You know, we didn't reveal to the conference attendees what we were doing. It was a very small group. We went in before the conference started. We had this session. I did create this device that we built. It's a larger subject on how this thing actually works. I don't think we have time for it. And Teresa, we may have even spoke about it briefly. I'm not sure when we chatted before, but torsion field is what this device actually creates. It creates spin, and so any mass in rotation creates this field that contains information about its source. And so when you use detectors to quantify torsion fields, they have some unusual properties about their origin. So one of the oddities about torsion fields is that they're not bound by the speed of light like everything in the electromagnetic field spectrum is. It's instantaneous at the detection point, so it's faster than the speed of light, and it's believed that people create torsion fields. So I wanted to see if you could sort of amplify this torsion field by using a generator that would assist with that process. I'm not the first to do it, but nobody's built one exactly like this. Nobody's used it the way we tried to use it. We tried to use it during this session just to see if it had any effect. What I did not expect to happen was that a photograph would result of an individual that physically can appear in the room. So the reveal that we did at the Glen Tavern event just this past March, it was sold out. So the room was full. The hotel was full. Every room was taken. We actually had another overflow hotel that we contacted and made arrangements for, but people generally like to stay at the location where a conference is going to be, if at all possible. So once the hotel was filled up, we said, you know what, we're actually going to have this conference room pretty much filled. We don't have even it's a good idea to start filling up an overflow hotel because then it's going to be too packed in the conference room. So it was filled. We did the reveal. I contacted everybody that had anything to do with that, the original experiment, including the Los Angeles Police Department forensic photographer that tried to help us recreate the photo that was captured by an amateur sports photographer who came in after we did the experiment. He's the one that got the photo. In the photo appears a woman that seems to have a resemblance to what we created with the thought form, with the mode of dress, certainly where she appears. But we couldn't replicate it. So the challenge that we had at this particular conference, okay, now we have another hotel full of people. We have another 75 attendees right here. That's all we can really fit in the place. We filled up the hotel again. Let's see if all these people, everybody's got cameras nowadays, let's see if somebody can replicate this photo. And some people say, we think we can figure out how this happened. And, of course, nobody could. Nobody could replicate it. And I was kind of hoping because it's part of the, again, the learning process. Let's see, why is this anomalous photo even exist? It shouldn't. This person shouldn't be showing up the way she does. And all the metadata is intact with the camera. We got it right off the card. So there was no manipulation, no photoshopping, yet you have this woman that appears in this dress. And then I end up going, well, this is unusual attire. We described the color and the sound, but the unusual trimming on this apparel is unusual. So I ended up Googling 1910 women's fashion because the hotel was built in 1911, and we created Pearl from that era, Pearl being the thought form that we wanted to manifest. And sure enough, during that period, it was sort of the opposite of what you had during the Victorian era and the Edwardian era, where instead of these tall collars and covering as much skin as possible, frilly sleeves, it was the complete opposite. You had trim on a low circular collar and three-quarter sleeves that had trim, and that's how this woman appears only in a mirror. She doesn't appear anywhere in the lobby, and we had this session right in front of that mirror. It's a double arch 100-year-old mirror that's been there since the hotel was built. So it was quite an event. We still get emails about it. So people keep asking us, are we going to have another one if we have a repeat? And so Anita, you know, we had a conversation. She tweeted the other day, about we're thinking about having another one, because we had a conversation about it now that hiatus started. So we think we're going to have another one, but there's something totally new that I'm going to be incorporating this time. I did do other stuff. I did, at this past one, the Pearl Experiment, Glenn Tavern In Reveal, I used a random event generator. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those from Princeton. Those are devices that have a quantum tunneling action in the electronics where you shoot an electron stream at a barrier, and half the time, if it's calibrated properly, you will get sort of a ghosted electron that appears on the other side of the insulator. Physically, that shouldn't happen. Yet, on a quantum level, it does anyway, because on a subatomic level, none of the rules that we adhere to seem to apply on a quantum level. So we use that to see if we could influence the outcome of the random event generator during this event. So that was the live experiment that we conducted during this past event. But for this new one, I'm doing something totally different, kind of based on torsion fields, kind of based on perceptions, kind of based on out-of-body experiences. And I'm kind of really amping up the science this time. It's a bit ambitious, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
That sounds great, and I can't wait to hear about it. And definitely, I'm going to try to be there. We'll see how things go. That's just one of the things that you work on. Another thing that we wanted to discuss with you tonight, and this is also covered in one of your documentaries, your other documentaries include The Queen Mary and The Stanley Effect. And we want to talk a little bit about The Stanley Effect and the piezoelectric effect and what it is and how it works at the Stanley. For those who are not familiar with it, you can give us the quick and dirty version and explain your work in that field.
Okay. One of the reports that is consistent at the Stanley Hotel is a feeling of being touched, pushed, shoved. It's physical interaction. And other places have that occasionally, but it's pretty consistent at the Stanley. And they even lead groups into certain areas where other people can experience it. And I try to be very objective. I go in. Sometimes I separate myself from groups. I don't want to be influenced by other people's experiences. But sure enough, at Stanley Hotel, I had that same experience of actually kind of walking through a field where the body seems to vibrate for a moment. And then, I try to back up and see if I could locate where this was occurring, and it didn't repeat itself. But in a separate part of the hotel, I had that same sensation of being touched in my temple, and I thought it was this another lady that was in the concert hall where I was. I thought it was her, like, trying to get my attention and wrap me on the temple, and I turned around, suddenly, because it surprised me, and I scared her, because I suddenly, all of a sudden, I'm facing her, and I realized, oh, gosh, she's, 8 feet away. She didn't touch me. And she's like, are you okay? And I said, yes, I'm fine. I didn't want to tell her that. I thought she touched my temple, But it made me realize, alrighty, there's something going on here at the Stanley Hotel. So I embarked on obtaining a geological report. And the state of Colorado was very gracious in participating in that. And there's granite domes, and in the granite domes you've got quartz and you've got magnetite, and quartz, when it's under pressure, tectonic pressure, that being the pressure of the dome itself, it creates voltage. If you apply pressure to quartz, it creates electricity, and so as it's beginning to change shape, it emits a charge, and the opposite is true. If you charge quartz, it'll change shape, it'll vibrate. And that's how quartz crystal watches keep perfect time. You apply a little charge and it oscillates, and that oscillation creates a timing signal that can then very accurately create watches and clocks for. So that's how, you're wearing it on your wrist right now. If you have a quartz watch, it's got the piezoelectric properties built into it. Same thing with those lighters that have a little electronic spark. That's a piece of synthetic piezoelectric ceramic. And if you apply pressure to it when you depress it, and it's an electric spark. It's not like a battery-operated spark in that sense. It's the piezoelectric unit inside of it. So since quartz can do it, and since the standard of health built on it, and since Ethel Stanley built this power plant to power the Stanley Hotel before they really had a full grasp on the safety of electrical wiring, they actually overpowered the hotel multiple grounds. So you've got ground arcs that sort of swoop across the hallways there. You have 11 to 15 milligauss constantly, as opposed to what you would expect between 1 and 2 in a modern location right next to, like, a where you've got an electrical appliance running. 1 or 2 milligauss compared to 10 times that amount, that's pretty substantial for it to be a constant field of that effect. So, like, okay, you've got this piezoelectric-based dome the hotel is built on. It's overpowered, so therefore the quartz is already oscillating underneath the hotel, but why are we feeling it? So I did a little more research, and I found out that the human skeleton also is piezoelectric, just like quartz. So if you energize a person's skeleton, you have minute vibrations and shape changes in your skull and throughout your bones. And I believe that being perceived by people as being an external touch when it's an internal skeletal shape change. So that was the basis for the Stanley effect. And I cover all that science inside the DVD. And in between the Stanley DVD and World's Largest Ghost Town, there was the Queen Mary DVD. And that's a whole other piece that talks about what happens when you have captive energy over water. So those are the three. I think I'm actually going to take the material I have for the Pearl Experiment, and cut another DVD out of that. During the hiatus period, I'm not one to necessarily sit still, even though I have a lot of things on my plate right now. I do want to put that DVD together so other people can see what we did to obtain the results that we did. So that'll be my next one.
And I highly recommend these DVDs to anybody who's interested in the paranormal field. You're covering, you know, some well-known locations that people would be familiar with, but you're giving it a little bit of a different twist. And I think that this kind of work is very important. It goes beyond just looking for ghosts and looking for thrills. And the science and the theories that you talk about are really something that I think needs to be explored more. And Eric and I are actually covering a couple of those locations in our book, the Queen Mary and the Stanley Effect. And we can't wait to experience some of what you've experienced at these places. I myself have been to the Queen Mary. I've not been to the Stanley yet, but I hope to be getting there sometime soon. And I think that anybody who has not seen these DVDs, besides just watching the different episodes that have been covered on the various TV shows, definitely need to take a look at them and see some of this work and see what else is involved. It sounds technical, but I think that once you really grasp what's happening, it seems to make sense. At least it does for me. It clicks a little bit better in my head when you see it. So I hope you do put this out about the Pearl Experience. I think that it'll be fascinating.
Yeah, well, Bill, that's for me. I'm entering this field kind of primarily from a journalistic standpoint. I've been a writer and an author and kind of covering various things. And I actually got into the paranormal field really through the media door. I started interviewing people such as yourself, kind of the stars of many of the shows. And I just found it fascinating. I found the commonalities between them and the differences in terms of their world views and the doors that they took to get into this really fascinating. And from a practical standpoint, a lot of those interviews were among the most highly trafficked that I've ever done. So I thought, wow, you know, this is something that fascinates me. I love watching these shows. I find them really fascinating. And I'm coming at it, as I say, kind of from a journalistic standpoint, but also from a philosophical standpoint. I am fascinated by the implications of these things. And I think that's where the scientific part of it is so interesting as well, because what you're doing, unlike so many other people, or virtually anyone really, at least who I've talked to, is you are providing a scientific foundation for how this could be. you're giving an explanation of what kind of energy might this spirit energy be, and where do these things come from? And I find that absolutely amazing. And man, you touched about 10 of my buttons when you were talking about the quantum side of things, with the entanglement between particles, where they're in two places at once until you measure them. And I to me, it just seems logical that the weirdness, the illogic, the seeming illogic, or at least the counterintuitiveness of quantum theory and quantum behavior, has to have something to do with spiritual energy and what we're seeing. Does that make sense for you? Could you maybe just briefly give us, because of course we're running out of time. I can't even believe how fast it's gone. We're under 5 minutes now. But I would just love to hear just a real brief version of your worldview of how all this stuff fits together.
Well, I mean,
sorry.
Minutes or less.
It's a very fair question. I mean, science moves so slowly because people will defend their positions that they base their careers on, and that's a human frailty. You know, people don't want to be proven wrong, and sometimes people that are right, their work is then after their own death, their work and their research then becomes validated. And that's sad, because the status quo is to not upset and not change things that are being taught. So you kind of have to go out on a limb and feel like you've got nothing to lose. Now, today is Tesla's birthday. Now, he's a guy who I feel that, you know, really deserved a much better shape than he got, because he died poor, alone, neglected, lost the respect, lost the funding. Yet
he was the anti-Edison, wasn't he?
He sure was. And as a matter of fact, I demonstrate some of his principles at many of the conferences that I go to. And even though I explain what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to do. I'll show you diagrams. I'll show you blow-up versions of it on a PowerPoint. Here's what I'm going to do, and then watch me do it. And then I do it. I'll perform a little experiment for people, and they still don't believe it. There's no trickery involved when you manipulate electromagnetic fields. So Tesla believed that you could broadcast energy, which you can. And when you broadcast energy, you can embed information into it. Similar to what I was talking about with the torsion field, that it carries information about its source, but EMF is a different form of energy. It's one of the four accepted forces of the universe is electromagnetism. The other two are the weak and strong nuclear forces, and then you have gravity. The fifth force that is slowly being acknowledged is torsion. And torsion is the most fascinating of all, because it's the closest to explaining spiritual energy, and it's instantaneous. It's also connected to extrasensory perception. It's how you know somebody's going to call that's 1,000 miles away. You go, gosh, you know, so-and-so, I haven't heard from them in ages, and the phone rings, and it's them. Is that always a coincidence? I don't think so. Sometimes, yes. Always, no. How is it happening? How is the connection happening? It's happening through torsion fields, I believe.
No, that's great. That's an explanation that I have never heard, and I think everybody's experienced that, or at least knows somebody who's experienced that. And you've got a scientific basis for that. That's fascinating. It's amazing.
You're going to see that's what actually I'm doing now. I've assembled some of the instrumentation already. It's taken decades for this underground physics community to design replicatable experiments. And I followed all those schematics. I've contacted all those that have had a hand in it that are living. And I'm cooperating with the Stanford group, and I'm going to be demonstrating these effects on what happens. My first subject that I'm going to be testing it on are those that do remote viewing, because they're the ones that are involved with this what's called psychic transfer of information, but it's actually a biological effect. It's something that we're all born with, we all can do it. Some people don't believe they can do it. If you don't believe you can do it, then you're wrong. If you do believe you can do it, you may be able to. How? I'll show you how. And I'll measure it, and I'll see this is a tangible form of energy that can be quantified. I've already started putting together the gear to do it, too. I'm so excited.
Amazing. Wow. We have barely scratched the surface. I can certainly see how you guys talk for 2 hours very easily last time around. Well, Bill, we're as we wind down here, if I understand how Block Talk Radio still works, we don't disappear when the show is up, and which is in 15 seconds. The live aspect does, but we're still being recorded for the podcast, which is actually how most people listen to the show anyway, because we will exist in the search engines for till the end of time, or at least till the end of the internet. But this is really amazing stuff. I mean, we would love to have you back on when you're a little further along. I would love to hear more about the torsion and experiments and how that's going. And, it sounds like you have something planned out, and I'm sitting here on pins and needles. I want to know that is and when that's happening and where that's going to be. And I surely want to know what the results are. That's some amazing stuff. And like I say, it really fits in with the way my brain works in that, on the one hand, there's so much what would appear to be objective evidence, quote unquote, that would seem to, on some level, in some way, substantiate the paranormal. On the other hand, okay, if this stuff exists, even if it's just a tiny fraction, a tiny percentage, if it exists, then there does have to be, at least ultimately, I would think, a method of explaining. It sounds like you're really working exactly right in that area.
I am. As a matter of fact, if any of the listeners, either live or podcast, want to learn more about some of the serious science that is actually occurring right now, if you go to cihs.edu, that stands for the California Institute of Human Science, and it's a research institute. And I'm a psychology major there, a graduate student, and I'll be speaking at a conference coming up on July 20th to the 22nd, along with some of the brightest physicists that are out there. I'm honored to be standing alongside these people, sharing the stage. We'll be covering torsion fields, energy as thought, the memory of water. I'll be covering thoughtful manifestation as well. So if you can attend that, please do. So check it out, cihs.edu.
Wow, that's amazing stuff.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Bill. Again, it's been a pleasure to speak with you again, and we'll chat soon. I know we have some questions for the book. Thanks again for your time. This has been amazing. And again, yeah, we could talk for hours. Told you, Eric. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Bill. Take care. And everybody, I am Teresa Argy, the Haunted Housewife, along with Eric Olson.
Thank you so much, Bill and Teresa. Really enjoyed it. I think this is a great way to kick off the show. And really, this is the first actual tangible public manifestation of our new brand, the America's Most Haunted Brand. So I am very excited. Had a great time. And thanks so much, Bill. Really fascinating, fantastic show.
Oh, you guys are a lot of fun to talk to. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. So you guys have a great night.
You
Thank
too.
You. You too.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.